Can electronic symptom monitoring help patients with advanced cancer?
An unhealthy lifestyle, remnant cholesterol, and coronary heart disease.
What do we know about Alzheimer's disease blood markers and their helpfulness in other kinds of dementia?
And maybe a transient ischemic attack isn't so transient.
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, how about if we turn right to JAMA Neurology? I find this issue of TIAs, gosh, we've been prognosticating that they're really not that bad, and maybe they aren't as ostensibly benign as we thought.
All right, so a transient ischemic attack is supposed to be someone that has a neurologic deficit that goes away, usually within minutes. And if you actually do imaging, you can't detect that there's anything wrong. They're thought to be fairly benign, although they are harbingers that people are at increased risk of stroke. And so we typically treat them with antiplatelet agents and make sure that people's diabetes and high blood pressure is controlled. This new study indicates that maybe transient ischemic attacks really aren't so transient after all. It's a study was actually designed to look at 30,000 black and white community dwellers, 45 years or older, living in the United States. And they followed these participants over time. Now, none of them had had a stroke. None of them had a TIA. They were just following them to determine what the risk factors were. During this time, they did extensive neurocognitive testing as well, following for about 14 years. About 350 had a TIA and about almost 1,000 had a stroke. They have neurocognitive testing before and neurocognitive testing afterwards. When people had a stroke, there was a rapid decline in cognition and then a fairly substantial decline in the cognitive function afterwards. People that had a TIA, well, immediately after the TIA, they didn't have any cognitive dysfunction. But then when they followed them over the long term, their decline in cognitive function was just as steep as those that had a stroke, and obviously much steeper than those that had neither of the two.
This is, of course, very concerning, and I think that the central problem centers around a lot of what I've observed also in pain management, and that's that patients themselves report this phenomenon, and we have no objective way of assessing it. And therefore, we've got this sometimes paternal attitude, and sometimes just like, oops, can't do anything about it, so therefore, let's not really focus on this. To me, it says we really need to figure out a way to objectively assess a TIA.
Not only assess whether it's there, the subsequent issue is, well, how do we prevent the cognitive decline? And what's the cause of it? It suggests there may be something perhaps like systemic inflammation or something else that we need to address so that even though the neurologic deficit goes away, they're not out of the woods.
And we need a more comprehensive view of the whole thing.
Yeah. These are people that didn't have additional neurologic events, just continued cognitive decline. And maybe we need to continue testing those individuals after the TIA.
Since we're in JAMA Neurology, let's stay there. We've been talking a lot on this podcast and me elsewhere about these blood-based biomarkers for Alzheimer's disease. They're increasingly prominent clinically. These folks are looking at, well, what predictive value or not do they have with other types of what results in dementia? In this case, they're looking at frontotemporal lobar degeneration syndrome. These people are uniquely positioned to look at this because they are part of the University of California, San Francisco Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. They have been accumulating lots of brains from folks after they die, and they've been developing a lot of different tests and assessments. And so in this case, they're looking at three different plasma biomarkers. That's phosphorylated tau-217 or p-tau-217, neurofilament light chain, NFL, and glial fibrillary acidic protein, or GFAP. And all of them are being used, as I said, clinically, their advantage being that they're plasma markers. They had a total of 349 people in this study. They wanted to look at how predictive or how accurate were these three markers, particularly when there were co-pathologies with Alzheimer's disease. I would also note that in the frontotemporal dementia, I'm going to call it that, Alzheimer's disease is frequently a co-pathology there. What they found was that the markers, really, the only one of them that turned out to be very useful at all was the plasma p-tau217. The other two didn't perform, added little to no diagnostic value, either alone or in combination with the tau measurement. So, right now, those things need to kind of get put back into the box and further investigated. There is validation, of course, of the plasma tau measurement, and I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of that.
People that are thought to have non-Alzheimer's dementia, when you look at it pathologically, they have some features of Alzheimer's disease. And the reason why this is important is as we develop ongoing therapies for Alzheimer's, maybe we can use those in these particular cases. But how do you tease that out? Well, as you mentioned, this blood biomarker does that.
Also, we can avoid using Alzheimer's disease therapies in people who don't have that particular type of pathology, which I think is just as important.
Absolutely. And I don't think that many clinicians realize that there's enough of an overlap or co-pathology. One type of dementia doesn't mean that you can't have another type contributing to the overall decline of the patient.
The authors also note that female sex had a small positive effect size on all of the biomarkers. I think that's also an important point to keep in mind clinically.
The next question is going to be, okay, what do we do if we're just doing routine blood testing and we detect it and no one has any clinical symptoms yet? That may be the person that could potentially benefit from very early therapy.
None of these biomarkers are actually very good at that stage of disease. Let's turn to your next one.
Elizabeth, this is The Lancet Regional Health. Unhealthy lifestyle, remnant cholesterol, and risk of coronary heart disease. There's not a listener within 500 miles that doesn't realize that unhealthy lifestyle contributes to the risk of coronary heart disease. Unhealthy lifestyle contributes to the increase in LDL cholesterol. But these other cholesterols, we call them remnant cholesterols, could be a significant risk factor as well because they can intercalate into the arteries and cause inflammation and atherosclerosis and blockage, leading to heart attack or stroke. To try to tease this out, this particular study had over 104,000, in fact, almost 105,000 individuals in the Copenhagen General Population Study. They were free from coronary heart disease when they examined them. They followed them for a median of about 2 years. About 2,500 developed a heart attack, and almost 4,000 developed coronary heart disease. And they said, okay, what's the contribution of this remnant cholesterol to each of these? They corrected for the unhealthy lifestyles that I talked about. Even after correcting for those things, remnant cholesterol in individuals that smoked explained about 15% of the excess risk of heart attack or coronary heart disease. For those that had low physical activity, this remnant cholesterol accounted for about 20% of the excess risk. And for those on a bad diet, about 12 to 14% of the risk. And it tells us that we need to be addressing not only LDL cholesterol, but the remnant cholesterol.
Okay, so I'm starting to feel a little bit overwhelmed by all of these factors and their relative contribution to cardiovascular disease and atherosclerosis. We also talked about recently lipoprotein A, and so I want you to tell me what is your composite picture of this whole thing?
Okay. Well, lipoprotein A is genetically determined. We will soon have therapies available. For the LDL and the remnant cholesterol, unhealthy lifestyles contribute substantially to the increase of both of those. So, correcting the lifestyle, that will lower the remnant cholesterol and LDL cholesterol both. If that's not sufficient, we have pharmacologic measures, statins, PCSK9 inhibitors, even fibrates.
And if you were a betting guy, would you say that we're going to start measuring this remnant cholesterol and use it clinically to, say, accelerate therapy?
Well, Elizabeth, many of us already do that. We haven't had the study just to quantitate how much excess risk is associated with that. This study nails it down.
So start looking at that, folks, when you get that report after you get your blood drawn, and you'll see that in there also. Let's turn to Nature Medicine, a population I care about a lot. These are folks with advanced cancers. And this is a study looking at whether they can self-report their own symptoms using usually electronic means, but sometimes by a telephone interface. And this is something that's called the PROTECT study. This has been done a number of times in a number of different countries, and here is this domestic version of this. They are looking at electronic patient reported outcomes, or PROs. They recruited 52 oncology practices in a cluster randomized trial. Patients who had metastatic cancer were invited to complete weekly symptom surveys. Their primary outcome, interestingly, was overall survival, but their secondary outcomes were emergency visits, time to deterioration of physical function, symptoms, health-related quality of life, and patient satisfaction. They had almost 1,200 enrolled patients. There was no difference in their survival. Even the authors parenthetically suggest that that hard outcome of survival is probably not what's germane in terms of taking a look at this intervention. They did have a prolonged time, those who filled out these patient-reported symptoms, to their first ED visit compared with usual care, an overall 6.1 reduction in their cumulative incidence of ED visits. They delayed their deterioration of physical function, and they had improved health-related quality of life. The patients also felt that this intervention improved their discussion with their care team. They felt more in control of their care and would have recommended this intervention to other patients. And finally, I have to give kudos to these authors. I'd love to know how they did this. Patients completed almost 92% of their expected weekly symptom surveys. That is so impressive. This is a win-win. Anything that enables patients, particularly at this point in their lives, to feel more in control of their care, have better discussions with their care teams, and these other so-called soft outcomes, I think is well worth pursuing.
But here's how they achieved such a high success rate. They had the individuals report on a weekly basis what their symptoms were, but they could use a computer or a smartphone or an automated telephone system. So it really covered all different types of communications, whatever someone is most comfortable using. If the person had severe or worsening symptoms, it triggered an alert that notified the care team, and the care team would contact the individual near real time, resolve it, help the individual. So the success rate was very high because they allowed different types of communication and they got back with the patient. And as you noted, the patients were more likely to stay at home. They had a better quality of life and they have felt better in control. I think this is a great thing. And the nice thing is the way they did it, it can be applicable in a number of different situations. And it's not high cost. It does take some training. You have to have someone on the other side to be able to deal with those real time. But that's what providing care to these patients is all about.
Indeed. Let's also take a look at this patient population because it's really quite broad. They had almost 80% of their enrollees were white, 40% almost had high school education or less, 17% had never used the internet, and almost 27% were in rural practice locations where it's historically much more difficult to employ these kinds of things. They had 64% using the web-based interface, while 36% plus used the telephone. So they really captured a broad range of people with capabilities and resources that were available at their disposal.
Yeah, this is clearly a study that demonstrates both the feasibility and the benefits of implementing this in what I would call a real-world cancer population.
Yes, indeed. I hope we start seeing this nationally. On that note, then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.